Good morning. Well, what I did was I went back to my box full of slides collected over innumerable years and went through those and picked out a bunch of slides that I thought would interest me and hopefully you. And as you've heard me say before, what I value most is having been able to construct a career studying this marvelous plant, the cotton plant, probably without any research on this subject, is probably the most studied plant. We've been looking at this thing for eons since we've been using it as a source and object of our attention for ever since we got up on two legs. And we still don't really understand all that it can do. And it reminds me of my one punchline, one-liner of my career, which I quote quite often because us non-comedians, when we make a one-liner, we remember that. So I'll tell you my punchline before I start, and then you can go about your business. I was sitting in Frank Misner's office one year, and all of you know Frank Misner, principal grower, former president of the Cotton Council and so forth. And it was October, and he was fretting about the fact that the cotton was not picking out as much as it looked like it ought to. And to his eye, and he said to me, he said, "Jack," he says, "I've grown 40 crops. My daddy before me grew 40 crops. This land has been in cotton continuously for 100 years. Why don't I understand it any better than that? Why does it keep doing things that I don't understand?" And so I looked at him and I said, "And how long have you lived with your wife?" Same problem. When I came on, and that was 1954, which is a shock to me to remember that it was that long ago, my superiors at the USDA said, "What you should do is concentrating on what causes the plant to flower, how the flowers are formed, and what limits the productivity of this plant." And as I think about that, what else is there to study? You know, so the first thing I tried to settle for myself, let's see if I understand this object, this thing that's before me, was how the plant initiated the flower. From where did the flowers occur? And I took a look at the branching habit of the plant and discovered that it didn't look like the book said it should look. Cook and others, Frank Eden, had put out a picture of two branches, one called the axillary and the other called the extra-axillary. And the axillary caused vegetative branches, they said, and the extra-axillary caused fruiting branches. Well, when I looked at the plant, it didn't look that way to me. As you see here, this, and I say this, to me, that photograph, that particular photograph, is about as pretty a photograph as I've ever taken. That is artistry, and it's cotton plant's artistry. Those two branches, and you see the, let's see if I've got a pointer. Do I have a pointer? Yeah, there it is. This is the vegetative axillary. And down here is the what they call the extra axillary. Only that's not a separate, it's not a extra axillary as such. It's the axillary of this branch. So there are two branches here. one the axillary branch, and the other an axillary in the axle of this profile. Profile. So I had to become an anatomist and describe the actual habit of the plant, which is to make one branch per leaf, one axillary per leaf. It always leaves behind a profile, which allows it to store another axillary, which will grow out when the plant needs it to. And I am not surprised to say that I imagine most woody plants do this. They have to have a site for those dormant axillaries to grow out. And then when does the plant receive the signal that causes it to make its first flower? Well, it looks about like this. It's got two leaves. And what are the influences that turn the plant on to flowering? So one of the things that has always been observed about the plant was that it is sensitive to the environment. So I asked the question, what environmental influences would turn on the plant and cause axillary to become or not become a flowering branch. Now these are the positions of the axillaries as they are up in the terminal, in the terminal seven nodes. They're about seven nodes above the first expanded leaf in various stages of development. And what happens is that down from the terminal, you can't tell the axillary and what form it will take until about four nodes back of the terminal. And then you see it develop as this one is right here, just a rudimentary three bracts in a whorl. Those bracts then become altered leaves then become the three bracts of the square. The formation of the flower is that ordinarily a plant makes a leaf and two stipules at each node. If it's a flower, it converts that leaf and two stipules into the three bracts that are the three bracts of the square. And then the petals are internal to that. So I asked the question, what does temperature do? The upland cottons are not particularly day length sensitive or light quality sensitive, but they are temperature sensitive. And so I exposed plants to both day temperature and to night temperature and found that both of these, both day and both night temperature, if it is too warm, will delay the formation of the first flower. And this is a graph of how long, this is node of the first flower. You can see the slight little step down at higher temperatures during the day, which causes the plant to grow faster, and the night temperature then determines the position of the first flower. Well, then I observed, and this is the photograph of the species Gossypium aridum. And aridum taught me, this is one of the plants that I appreciate having known. This plant is a desert species of Mexico. And it has a curious plant flowering habit, which people told me about, and I didn't believe that it could do this. It grows during the wet season. And then when it hits and makes long vegetative branches. And then when the dry season comes along, it drops its leaves because the leaves are stressed, and then it flowers backwards down the stem. And that is a very curious thing to wonder about, because where do these flower buds come from on a stem that has no leaves? So I grew one out in my greenhouse and didn't water stress it. And what it did was it grew vegetatively and set dormant axillaries. And then along about January, when it was the day length was right, it began flowering up the stem, but it also began flowering backwards down the stem. So it was opening flowers in both directions along that branch. And what it had done is it had set dormant flowering branches on those nodes which were growing during the early part of the season. And the dormancy breaks backwards because it's more seriously dormant on the first flowers formed. Well, this taught me that the upland cotton is remembering Giardium is one of the D species, and it's one of the progenitors of our AD upland cotton. What upland is remembering is its history, its forebears, and those first two nodes, as we all recognize, the first two nodes that set the flower on the upland cotton are more or less, or a little bit dormant. They don't come out and flower, and sometimes the second flower blossoms opened before the first one does. You will see the two flowers occur on the same day from the first two nodes, and frequently those first two nodes are not multi-branched flowering sympodium. So what upland cotton is doing is having a little bit of that dormancy recalled in the flowering habit of actually upland cotton. So Adam taught me something. So I've said that the square is a modified leaf with two stipules, and if the plant is not thoroughly committed to making a flower, it may make four bracts instead of three. And the fourth bract is its attempt to make the next node on what would be the branch from that axil. And the you can see here, well, these are three bract squares, and then off over here is actually a four bract square. And we'll talk a little bit about the four bract squares in a moment. Then the next question, of course, is then why do they fall off? And that's the major concern of the growers, and was one of the major reasons why all of us got into the research business on flowers. Well, it does that. And this is an example of a serious case of square shed. In my early days of my career, every once in a while, someone would say to me, well, the crop didn't flower right in Louisiana or Texas, and I would go and look at these instances, but I was always after the fact, like this field in California in 1969. And it was difficult to ascertain why that occurrence had happened. Well, in 1975, it happened to me on my research station in Arizona. The plant didn't flower right. This is the number of flowers which were occurring in plots on the research station in Phoenix. In 1974, you got a typical number of flowers per unit of row. And in 1975, they just weren't there. And so I was put to the task of answering the question, why did those squares fall off? And what I, after looking at everything, including the phases of the moon, and I don't know what all I examined as to why, what was different about 1975 than 1974, I came across a bit of data down here on the bottom. The number of Lygus bugs in 1974 is down here riding along baseline. Very few of anything. And then once it hit the middle of July, there was a spike in numbers. But in 1975, the number went up in early July, and this hung around at a pretty good pace. The entomologists had not felt that this was a serious outbreak of plant bugs, but it was the only thing I could discover that was different about 1975 and 1974. And so I stood up on my hind legs in a place like this and announced that I believe the plants were shedding their squares because of plant bugs. And I felt like the roof had caved in, because that was not the accepted behavior of the Lygus bugs. So I had to sort of become an entomologist for a while and discover whether I could tell the difference between a square which had fallen off because of bug damage and one which had fallen off for other reasons. And sure enough, you could see the damage by placing little growing points of the plant in little cages like this and putting a bug in there, and then what it did to the plant. And this isn't a very clear picture, but you can tell the difference between by slicing them open and see the damage done by the feeding. So I did a study which attempted to discover why the squares that fell off had reached the ground and what damaged them. And you can see from this table that early in the year, before about the 1st of July, the bugs were the dominant reason. There was something I call soft rot, which I could see in the damaged squares, but I didn't understand what was causing that soft rot. And then some due to worms and a little bit due to, well, as of about the 1st of July, we began to see fewer bug damage and more worm and some good deal of physiological shed. And so, once again, I was able to document that early in the season, a plant doesn't shed very many squares because of stress. A square, in my opinion, is pretty well self-sufficient from needing carbohydrate from the plant, from the other leaves. It is got enough leaf surface. The terminal of the plant has enough leaf surface to make all the firm tissue that it needs to plant. The square doesn't have any dry weight. It just is soft tissue. So it will not shed unless it is under very extreme physiological stress. Well, having announced that, here is the four-back square, and many of these squares that were shedding with rot had four bracts. And so the question was, what is damaging those squares? And the answer is thrips. A square in the terminal of the plant is protected from wandering, meandering thrips. And my one-liner there is, I've never in my career seen a cotton plant that didn't have thrips on it. And I mean that seriously. I don't care if it's a greenhouse which you've sterilized forever, the plants will have thrips. I think thrips come with the seed or something. They just are there. And the plant is not damaged by these thrips. The terminal, which is all soft tissue and can be damaged by thrips, is protected by the thicket of hairs and little branches and leaves and stuff. And so the thrips can't get to the really soft tissue which it would feed upon. And the square, the soft tissue is the apex, which is forming the bracts and the, and by the time the three bracts are so tightly sealed that they prevent the thrips from approaching this naked meristem of tissue. But the fourth bract doesn't seal as tightly against the other three bracts as they do. And so there is a little gap caused by the fact that the fourth bract is not quite a complete triangle. And thrips walk in and they see a naked meristem and and they feed upon it and introduce a bacterium which will cause the soft rot. They don't do much damage of themselves, but they do introduce a rotting tissue which will take the square. Okay. I asked the question, what would happen if I went out and trimmed a bit of tissue from a three-bract square and opened it up to this? And so, as you see, the normal bract that were untreated, had no square damage, had no thrips, whereas all of them that I treated had, or not all, but some of the treated ones had the soft rot and convinced me that thrips was the cause of this soft rot. Finally, during one event, I actually saw thrips emerging from a young square in the terminal and was convinced that he must be the bad actor. So that is the reason why plants like Deltapine 90, which was very popular in its day, would shed so many squares. Deltapine 90 made four-bract squares quite a bit, and they would fall off. Well, this caused the controversy of trying to answer why we were on the yield plateau. This is a graph of the yield from 1950 to about 1980 of the yield in the United States of America. And you will see there from about 1960 until 75 or so, we were on the famous yield plateau. And it's my opinion that we were on the yield plateau because we were not protecting the crop from plant bugs. And once the growers realized and became more serious about their treatment for plant bugs, we got back on to a yield increase, I think we're now on another yield plateau, but I leave it to you folks to figure out why that one happened and let the roof cave in on you when you stand up and say, I know the reason. And here's a curious plant. This is what I call crazy cotton. And crazy cotton is rather general term for plants that don't have a strong central stem. My definition of crazy cotton is a little differently from that. It is the central stem won't organize itself into a consistently growing meristem. The reason why that center portion of the plant makes funny looking leaves, it makes flowers that are not normal, is because something, and you can see that the plant is capable of making strong vegetative growth by these two outside branches that have taken off and performed the duty of the central. The reason why the central meristem of this plant will not organize itself is thrips. If something like a plant bug or a stink bug knocks out the terminal at a time when it then becomes raw and naked, then a family of thrips, and that this plant was exactly that, will get in there and this form a colony and continue to damage the new forming, let's see where I am, meristems, to the point that they never organize themselves into a consistent growing stem. And the other thing I want to say is that leaves titrate stress. In other words, the size of the cotton leaf is determined by when it receives water stress. All cotton plants will water stress themselves by developing enough leaf structure to use the water that it gets. And we know that leaves on a given variety in Arizona are smaller than those leaves in that variety in Mississippi. And it's because the leaves get, with the humidity of the location, there's a size that the piping of the cotton plant cannot supply. And at the fourth, fifth leaf down will flag in the afternoon, and that determines when it's going to stop expanding. And if you give it 100% humidity, the leaves will get that big by actual experience. I've seen them do it. The other thing that I noticed was that starch limits photosynthesis. During the day, a cotton plant will build up starch in its leaves and not be able to, because it can't ship out all the carbohydrate it's making. And by afternoon, it has a load of starch, which has begun to limit the photosynthesis. And from there on, it's just maintenance. Mostly, cotton plants do not add dry weight but they are not actively photosynthesizing as much as they do in the morning. The fact that photosynthesis limits yield is, we will get to in a minute. The other thing that I was charged with when I came on is, why does the plant cut out? Well, the plant cuts out because it is forming new leaves slower than it is opening blossoms. So it has a reservoir of new flower buds up from the white flower, and it uses up that reservoir. Why does it do that? I think it's because the carbohydrate supply is being translocated to the roots is being limited by the boa load, and its root development, which causes the plant to grow slower and therefore not produce new flowers as fast as it is as opening old flowers. And I found we had greenhouses in Arizona in which we could enrich the carbon dioxide. So we ran some experiments with enriched carbon dioxide and found that the plants, really the thing that was most noticeable about the reason why the plant was more successful in enriched carbon dioxide was that it delayed cutout somewhat. You can see this, the upward curve is essentially the same. It just is that the plant does not, it has enough carbohydrate to maintain its root system for a bit longer. It will, sooner or later, it will stress itself enough, even at the higher photosynthetic rate, to. So we ran another experiment with the help of Department of Energy, in which we gassed an open field with carbon dioxide. And this is the arrangement. We had it was a very neat experiment. Only with Department of Energy could we afford this thing. And there is a plenum of air on the ground below these pipes, which has enriched carbon dioxide, and then a sensor over on this side detecting which of those pipes is upwind, so that the wind is carrying a plume of enriched carbon dioxide across this circle. And this was called the FACE experiment, free air carbon dioxide enrichment. We ran that experiment and found that, yes, it did increase the yield in all developmental phases. And it increased that yield by about 45%. Well, 45% was the exact amount of our enrichment. So we stated that the plant increases its yield by the approximately the degree of the enrichment. So I ran a calculation which says that in the 50, 60 years that I've been observing, carbon dioxide has increased from 280 in my youth. High school chemistry was said that the atmosphere contained 280 parts per million CO2. It now contains about almost 400. And if you take the ratio of all those, you will see that in our experiment, we experiment from 350 to 550, a 45% increase. We got a 45% increase in yield. If you take the yield from 1950 to now, it's about 250% increase. But we can't take credit for all of that in our smarts. About 20% of that yield increase since 1950 is due to the fact that the CO2 in the atmosphere has increased. And cotton appreciates that. Thank you, ma'am, very much. We're glad for the extra photosynthesis per day. And it will, of course, appreciate going to 600. It doesn't care about global warming or any of those things about where the tides are going to go. Give me some more carbon dioxide. The other thing I want to state before I leave here is that pollen is sterile because of heat. And though I don't know an exact formula, I know that we ought to always quote in our temperature measurements of what the cotton plant is, leaf temperatures, not air temperatures, because the physiology and the enzymology of a cotton plant cannot know what the air temperature is. It only knows what temperature the tissue is at, and that is, and it's easy to measure, not as easy as taking the weatherman's statement of what the air temperature was, but we have devices which can measure leaf temperatures nowadays. Leaf temperatures are what drive pollen sterility, and in my rough hand notation, the heat index is a good measure of what leaf temperatures are. It's not exact, but heat indices of 100 over 105 Fahrenheit will cause pollen to go sterile in some varieties. Well, I've used up my time, so I won't. This was a plant which I trimmed 3/4 of the leaves off of, branches off of, to see what effect it would have on yield, and it had none. So the plant uses what it's got, and those branches which I left had all the yield on them. I've used up my time, and I appreciate your attention. Thank you.